VOA News. I'm Christopher Cruz reporting. The nation has begun its final farewell to its 41st president, George H.W. Bush. Associated Press Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
After a ceremony at Joint Base Andrews, where he flew from Houston aboard a presidential aircraft, the former president was brought to the Capitol and into the rotunda.
Here lies a great man.
House Speaker Paul Ryan was among those eulogizing President Bush, who will lie in state until Wednesday morning. He'll have a state funeral here in Washington before returning to his Texas library, where he'll be buried alongside his wife and young daughter.
The New York Stock Exchange and the federal government will both be closed on Wednesday in honor of Mr. Bush. That day has also been declared as a national day of mourning. The U.S.-led coalition fighting the Islamic State has targeted and killed a senior leader of the group in Syria who was linked to the murder of an American citizen. The Pentagon told the Voice of America Monday that coalition forces killed Abu al-Umarayan and several other Islamic State members during a precision strike Sunday in the Badaya district. The statement said al-Umarayan had given indications of posing an imminent threat to coalition forces, and he was involved in the killing of an American citizen and former U.S. Army Ranger named Peter Kasich. The terrorist was also directly involved with executing several IS prisoners. President Trump boasted Monday of his, quote, very strong and personal relationship with Chinese President Xi Jinping. He declared a new China-U.S. trade deal would immediately allow American farmers to sell more of their products to China. This is VOA News. The UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is warning that the world is in deep trouble because of climate change. He spoke Monday at the opening of 2 weeks of climate talks in Poland and called on nearly 200 countries represented in Poland to take the issue seriously. The World Health Organization says American experts are not needed to fight the Ebola outbreak in the Congo. Associated Press correspondent Mike Gracia reports.
The head of the World Health Organization says help is not needed from experts at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to battle the deadly Ebola outbreak in Congo. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus says what the U.N. Health Agency does need from the U.S. is financial and other support. Speaking to reporters in Geneva Monday, Tedros also noted that U.S. security guidelines prevent deployments of experts in conflict zones like eastern Congo. Many other countries have similar guidelines. Eastern Congo is experiencing the world's second deadliest Ebola outbreak.
Wounded Houthi fighters in Yemen's rebel-held Sana'a were evacuated Monday in advance of peace talks that are set to begin this month in Sweden. The Houthi were taken in ambulances to the airport to board a UN-chartered flight. The Saudi-led coalition said it had approved the evacuation of the wounded fighters. The evacuation had been a stumbling block in peace talks in September. The U.S. Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. said Monday it has found what it calls compelling evidence of genocide in Myanmar against the Muslim Rohingya minority. It called on the U.S. government and international governments to hold the Burmese military accountable. The announcement came on the same day that the Public International Law and Policy Group released a report saying the Myanmar military committed crimes against humanity, genocide, and war crimes against the Rohingya. The PILPG had been contracted by the U.S. State Department to study the crisis. Hungary's Central European University, founded by the billionaire George Soros, announced Monday it had been forced out of the country. The rector of the university said in a statement that the action was a, quote, arbitrary eviction. The university had been set up in 1991. It had been chartered in New York, but it's been in legal limbo for more than a year since Hungary changed higher education laws regulating foreign universities. The rector said this is unprecedented. A U.S. institution has been driven out of a country that is a NATO ally. You can find more on these and other late-breaking and developing stories from around the world, around the clock, at voanews.com and on the VOA News mobile app. I'm Christopher Cruz, VOA News. We'll be right back.
Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington, and today is Tuesday, December the 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering for you this morning. Former U.S. President George H.W. Bush is lying in state at the Capitol Rotunda in Washington as Americans honor the life of the country's 41st president. The Capitol was last evening opened for the public to pay their respects.
He was actually quite successful, arguably the best one-term president we ever had. He may be tied with John Adams and James K. Polk, but he's at least up at the very top end of a pretty large group of one-term presidents.
Larry Sabato is the head of the University of Virginia Center for Politics. In the DRC, 18 people were killed in clashes between the army and rebels loyal to a renegade former general in the eastern part of the country. And a new report says that artificial intelligence could be the answer to some of the continent's persistent problems.
We see a lot of benefit in Africa that's possible from artificial intelligence. But there are also real challenges in the way. Africa has the opportunity to catch up to some of the global leaders, but only if they make the right sorts of changes.
Logan Finucane is a senior policy analyst at Access Partnerships. Stay tuned. Those stories and more are coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Former U.S. President George H.W. Bush is lying in state at the Capitol Rotunda in Washington as Americans honor the life of the country's 41st president. The Capitol is open for dignitaries and the public to pay their respects through early today. Visitors will be allowed to walk past Bush's casket. Mr. Bush died in Texas, his home state, late Friday at the age of 94 after several years of failing health. He was sent off from Texas with a 21-gun salute and taken to Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland aboard the presidential aircraft that was made available by U.S. President Donald Trump. A motorcade carried the flag-draped casket to the Capitol, where a U.S. Army band played hymns as family and friends gathered. Bush's son, former President George W. Bush, looked emotional as he watched his father's casket placed in the Capitol Rotunda. In a service in the Capitol Monday, Washington officials gave tributes to Bush. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said America stands with the Bush family in, quote, mourning, but also in gratitude. Bush, who served a single term in the White House from 1989 to 1993, will receive a state funeral today at the National Cathedral in Washington, and most government offices will be closed for the day.
It's pretty obvious as people look back and as people are recollecting the Bush presidency, it looks a heck of a lot better than it did at the end of it. Bush, of course, was defeated for re-election, and most people at the time considered him a failed president. But now I think we can see in retrospect that he was actually quite successful, arguably the best one-term president we ever had. He may be tied with John Adams and James K. Polk, but he's at least up at the very top end of a pretty large group of one-term presidents.
Dr. Larry Sabato is the director of the University of Virginia Center for Politics. U.S. President Donald Trump tweeted that he will attend the funeral, saying that he looked forward to being with the Bush family to pay his respects to President George H.W. Bush. In the DRC, 18 people are dead after clashes between the army and rebels loyal to a renegade former general in the eastern part of the country. The violence comes ahead of an important election meant to replace President Joseph Kabila this month. Fighting killed 14 rebels and 4 soldiers in Fizi, a region south of Kivu, a mineral-rich province which is prone to ethnic tensions. The eastern clashes pit the military against rebels loyal to a former army general, William Amuri Yakutumba, whose militia is one of the armed groups operating in the region against Kabila. Now, even though artificial intelligence is still a relatively new technology, experts say that it has the potential to transform societies in ways that the steam engine and electricity have done. A new white paper published by the organization Access Partnership, one of the world's leading public policy firms in the tech sector, in collaboration with the University of Pretoria, says that artificial intelligence technologies have the potential to solve some of Africa's most persistent challenges by driving growth and development in sectors like agriculture and healthcare. Logan Finucane is a senior policy analyst at Access Partnership. He tells me that artificial intelligence will enable the continent to catch up with some of the global leaders in development.
Artificial intelligence is a set of digital technologies that help to automate processes that so far have been done by humans, from analyzing data sets to extract patterns, to facial recognition, to predicting weather patterns and other complex systems.
Can you talk to us about some of the areas in which artificial intelligence would be used or is being used currently to solve some of Africa's most persistent challenges?
Yeah, so we've identified four areas where we think artificial intelligence has the most opportunity to bring real benefits to Africa. The first is the financial sector, where there's already a lot of experimentation going on in Africa, and they're really leading the way in adopting artificial intelligence tools. There, it's going to mean better and more efficient banks that are able to extend services to more people, which is important for sustainable development. We also see a lot of potential in the agricultural sector, where there's also a lot of experimentation going on, and where so many of Africa's workers are currently employed. There, artificial intelligence will help improve the stability of rural incomes by empowering farmers with new tools like more advanced predictive tools to help them figure out when to sell their crops, when to plant, and run their operations more efficiently.
What does the report suggest are some of the changes that are necessary or needed on a governmental level in terms of policies for the citizens of these various African countries to benefit from artificial intelligence?
We see a lot of benefit in Africa that's possible from artificial intelligence. But there are also real challenges in the way. Africa has the opportunity to catch up to some of the global leaders, but only if they make the right sorts of changes. And there are serious policy obstacles that Africa is going to have to work to overcome. This includes helping to improve the health of the data ecosystem. Governments can do a lot more to try and make their own data more available, better structured, and higher quality, and available to the private sector to develop new applications. But they also need to focus on encouraging the growth of the digital economy. AI really runs on data, so the more people that are connected and participate in the digital economy, the more data that's available to develop and run AI on. Promoting connectivity is one of the most important things that governments need to focus on. There are over 267 million people in Africa that are currently not connected to the internet. Getting them online should be a priority to promote the growth of AI in Africa.
Some say that the continent has a high youth population and that it still needs to find ways to get them meaningful employment. Do they have reason basically to view AI as a technology that will take away even the few available jobs for these young people?
So a lot of people have concerns about AI taking away jobs, but I think it's more important to focus on how AI will transform jobs and create new types of jobs that we're not thinking about right now. You know, throughout history, when new technologies come through, people are afraid of automation taking away jobs, but it's always done the opposite. It's always ended up creating more jobs. Mm. And we think ultimately the same is going to happen with artificial intelligence. We just need to position workers to adapt and be able to fill new jobs that come along.
And finally, Logan, as we come to the end of our conversation today, and I really want to take to thank you for having taken time to talk to us this morning, what are some of the ethical questions that AI raises that were addressed in this report?
Yeah, so AI does present new challenges in the area of human ethics that we need to think about. These are, in some ways, unfamiliar challenges. You know, we've already seen how artificial intelligence can integrate new types of biases and operate in ways that have discriminatory effects in society. So we need to be vigilant to build AI systems that don't have these effects and to apply them in ways that are fair and equitable. We need to be thinking about these questions now and having conversations between all stakeholders, between governments, between the private sector and civil society. Everyone needs to be thinking about these issues and defining principles and ways of moving forward that means AI brings benefit for everybody.
That was Logan Finucan, a senior policy analyst at Access Partnership. He was speaking to me from his offices in New York City. In Uganda, a prominent human rights activist is calling out what she says is a rampant violation of human rights in the country. Maria Matembe, a former legislator and minister of ethics and integrity, blames the decline of respect for human rights on what she says is a greed for power. From Kampala, Uganda, reporter Mugume Davis Rwakarinji files this report.
While speaking at a public debate in Kampala yesterday, Monday, Matembe, a prominent rights activist and anti-corruption campaigner, said human rights violations are on the increase.
We should speak that truth and say that the crave for power, to stay in power forever, is the cause of all these things that have happened. Now you talk of democracy, democratic governance. Where is it if the people in opposition cannot organize, if they cannot conduct rallies, if they cannot do, how do you evolve and grow when principles according to which you would grow are not enforced?
Opposition leaders have been arrested or detained by security personnel for holding rallies or attempting to hold demonstrations. Recently, some members of the opposition, including MPs, were detained on charges of treason after campaigning for an opposition politician. They also claimed they were brutally tortured by security personnel during arrest and while in detention. Speaking at the same function, Uganda's Chief Justice, Bart Katureebe, concurred there are cases of human rights abuse in the country, but he quickly said there are institutions aimed at investigating and punishing human rights violators.
The Human Rights Commission was put there because we do recognize that there will be some people who will violate human rights. How do we deal with it? They can go to human rights, or the Human Rights Commission, or come to the courts. So you need to strengthen those organizations.
The judiciary has been blamed for having many case backlog and delaying to render justice, a claim Justice Katureebe puts on lack of funding. Uganda has ratified many international human rights conventions. The Ugandan constitution also provides for non-discrimination and equality for all citizens. And some specific provisions are enshrined in the constitution to ensure the rights of women, people with disabilities, and children. But Ambassador Attilio Pachifichi, the head of delegation of the European Union to Uganda, says, regrettably, cases of police brutality, gender-based violence, child abuse, discrimination of minority groups, political and press freedoms are among the human rights abuses so common in Uganda. Ambassador Pachifichi pledged for European funding to the judiciary sector.
There are instruments coming from the central budget of the European Commission. One is called the Initiative Human Rights Instrument, the European Instrument for Human Rights and Democracy. There are calls for proposals. That means, for instance, one wants to discuss, wants to support ideas and projects, actions on women lawyers, for instance.
The EU has donated over 60 million euros to the judicial sector. Some of these funds will be used to promote respect of human rights and rule of law in the country. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
From Uganda, we go to Zimbabwe, where the country is getting ready for another climate change-induced dry season, commonly known as El Nino. The International Fund for Agricultural Development, IFAD President Mr. Gilbert Honyipo, is in the country to meet with President Emmerson Mnangagwa. The aim is to discuss agriculture investments meant to improve food security in this southern African country. From the capital Harare, Columbus Mavunga brings us this report.
Gilbert Honkeyboom, the president of the International Fund for Agricultural Development, IFAD, comes to Zimbabwe when the country is facing food insecurity, largely attributed to climate change and lack of agriculture infrastructure. The former prime minister of Togo says he is in Zimbabwe to finalize Zimbabwe's funding by IFAD in the agriculture sector for the next 3 to 5 years.
For us to be able to finalize that, it's important to meet with different ministries, making sure that the priorities, the importance of food security, the importance of the challenge we have in the productivity, which call from different type of intervention, the access to the market. We talk about the El Niño, La Niña, and therefore, needless to mention, the importance of the climate change impact on the agriculture and the need to develop the resilience. And again, focusing on the women in the rural area. An area of importance for us as well is how do we encourage the youth to invest in agriculture.
Agriculture is Zimbabwe's backbone, but it has been declining over the past 15 to 20 years. According to the World Food Programme, about 2 million people, mostly in the rural areas in Zimbabwe, need food assistance until their next harvest, expected in April or May next year. But that harvest might not count much with the forecast of an El Nino-induced drought in Zimbabwe's 2018-2019 rainy season. Besides climate change, some observers say Zimbabwe's land reform program, which evicted experienced white commercial farmers and replaced them with black peasant farmers, affected production. Onkibo says with the proper funding, Africa can have enough produce for the continent's consumption needs.
I do believe that Zimbabwe is a very, very good example given the importance of agriculture in the Zimbabwe economy and social life, that we can contribute to develop this sector as well with the youth and the other sectors as related to food security, nutrition, as I said, and with the climate change dimension.
Onkibo is expected to visit Angola after Zimbabwe before leaving the continent for his base in Rome, where all food security UN agencies such as his IFAD, the World Food Programme, and the Food and Agriculture Organization are headquartered. Columbus Mavunga for VOA's Daybreak Africa, Harare.
After years of living in a state of limbo, Senegalese refugees in Guinea-Bissau are finally getting identification cards. Some of the refugees have been in the small West African country for more than 2 decades after fleeing unrest in Senegal's Casamance region. Ricky Shryok has more from the town of Pelundo.
Okay, Ibrahim Ingo, you have votre nom sur la liste.
Ibrahim Ingo fled southern Senegal in 1992 due to unrest in the country's Casamance region. Since then, he has lived in Pelundo, near Guinea-Bissau's border with Senegal. Today marks the first time he will register to receive his national identification card as a Guinea-Bissau citizen. He says the documents are important because they will allow him to move about the country freely without having to pay small bribes to the police, a tax often applied to foreigners. This year, the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, began registering the nearly 10,000 Senegalese refugees living in the country after Guinea-Bissau announced it would grant citizenship to all Senegalese refugees within its borders. Like Ibrahima, many of them arrived over 2 decades ago. Since 1982, waves of Senegalese have fled Casamance, the site of a low-intensity conflict between the government and the separatist movement of Democratic Forces for Casamance. UNHCR official Binya Tona says before becoming naturalized, the refugees had trouble moving around the country freely. He adds the national ID cards will also enable them to acquire a passport for future international travel if needed. Guinea-Bissau ranks as the 11th least developed country on the UN Development Index. Despite a lack of economic opportunities, Guinea-Bissau residents in the region have mostly welcomed their Senegalese neighbors, says Ingo. When he arrived, Palundo residents gave him land he could use to grow cashews and earn an income, he says. A resident of Palundo, Ocha Camara, says he does not mind if the refugees stay as long as they follow the rules of the country. He says the only caveat is that he thinks it's necessary for the government to register all the refugees if they are going to stay. On this day, 334 Senegalese refugees in Palundo are getting their ID cards. Amijata reflects on what the new documents mean to her and her family. She says that without paperwork, you're treated like a foreigner, but with the papers, she will have fewer problems. That also means almost 27 years after Jata fled her village, she will now have the freedom to call Guinea-Bissau home. Ricky Shryock for VOA News, Palundo, Guinea-Bissau.
Thank you, Ricky Shryock, for that report. And from Guinea-Bissau, we'll stay in West Africa, specifically Nigeria, where social media platforms are providing a platform for the growth of comedy in this populous West African nation, where millions are using platforms such as Instagram and Facebook to showcase their talents while connecting with a growing online audience. Samuel Okocha brings us this report from Lagos.
With over 20 million people, Lagos is Africa's largest city and Nigeria's commercial capital. It's a land of opportunity for many. It's also home to a new breed of comedians using social media to put food on their table.
Instagram, online comedy are giving us the opportunity for people to enjoy comedy wherever they are, whenever they want to, wherever and however they want to. That is super amazing. You can laugh at night, you can laugh in the morning, you can laugh in the afternoon, and the only transaction is your data.
Wole Arole started making comedy skits on Instagram in 2015. Now, he has nearly a million followers on Instagram.
The digital world and media is a major tool now, transforming lives, putting food on people's table, and we should not joke with it. Is it language of now? And anyone joking with it is just swimming against the tide.
With over 100 million internet users in Nigeria, majority of them accessing the internet through their smartphones, social media platforms such as Instagram is becoming the new TV and discovery channel for previously unknown talents. According to Obi Asika, Nigeria's creative industry mogul.
One of the things that social media has done is to unlock possibilities for a lot of people that never had access. So social media is great for self-starters, self-promotion, it's free marketing. And if you know how to use it and you're clever, you're talented, you get a view. I have had major Hollywood production companies contact me about certain Nigerian comedians just based on their Instagram. Those ones were not even well known in Nigeria. They were just good on Instagram. So obviously if you're a talent, you have to use the opportunity. You're talking about comedians. What about makeup artists? What about fashion designers? Instagram is huge for discovery for all those sort of people, and it's huge for monetization as well.
But becoming successful on social media is not a walk in the park. It also comes with a lot of hard work. Samuel Okocha, VOA News, Lagos, Nigeria.
And that's it for this Tuesday, December the 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. Join us again tomorrow for more African news and features right here on the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a good morning, Africa.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.